From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Free speech is a fundamental right, but it faces continual attacks. David French of National Review worries about attacks on the culture of free speech. He joins us to explain why. Association health plans are designed to help provide more access to good health insurance. A North Carolina congresswoman recently praised the plans on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. If you know the name Brian Kilmeade, it's probably because of his role as a morning co-anchor on Fox News. During a recent visit to Raleigh, Kilmeade also emphasized his love of American history. Plus, we'll delve into the likely impact of a recent court ruling striking down Obamacare. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Apple has passed up North Carolina for a $1 billion facility that state officials were hoping to snag, choosing Austin, Texas instead. And while most of the media coverage has cast this as a loss for North Carolina, the John Locke Foundation's John Sanders takes a bit of a different point of view. He's urging state and local officials not to conclude that North Carolina didn't offer a big enough package of tax incentives in order to lure Apple. John joins us now to talk about the issue. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks, Donna.
Nice to see you. John, of course, is Director of Regulatory Studies. Why didn't North Carolina get Apple?
I don't know all the reasons why North Carolina didn't get Apple. Apple made reasons based on a business decision. They chose Austin over Raleigh and Austin over many other places for reasons best known to Apple. One thing that I do know based on economic research is that it's very, very unlikely that our incentives package is the reason why they didn't come here.
John, do we have a sense of exactly what North Carolina offered up to Apple?
Not a full sense. We know that they have passed and then reduced the transformative welfare incentives, basically, for companies, which would have increased the amount of money they would be able to get back in tax rebates for their employees, for the amount of people that they hire and for how much that they're paying them and for how long they'd be able to get property tax rebates for, I think, up to 30 years in some cases.
So
it's a very, very lucrative offer.
It sounds like it's not just those tax rebates, those incentives for people they're employing, but a whole array of different things.
Yes, and they'd still be able to possibly access like One North Carolina and JDIG and those others as well.
Talk a little bit more about the issue of how that JDIG program works, JDIDIG, which stands for, let's see, Jobs Development
Investment Grants.
Investment
yes.
Grants, okay. Those have been in existence for a number of years, but
right.
There was a recent action taken by the General Assembly that appears now in retrospect to have been an effort to try to sweeten the deal, so to speak, for Apple.
Yeah, it might have been for Apple. It might have been for Honeywell. I don't know. But yeah, that does seem to be part of the reason for it. And what it did was for companies that have executive pay that are greater than $175,000 a year, it would allow them to get employment tax rebates based on their salary. So at a certain level, it's capped, and so they don't get any additional rebate beyond paying someone over $175,000. So it would have increased, I think, the maximum from about $6,000 to $16,000 that they would have been able to get back.
John, what I think is curious about the issue of the incentives, the special breaks, is that we essentially go out and decide that there's one particular company or maybe a couple of them or an industry that we're going to favor with tax policy and public policy. What does all that mean for the other hundreds, thousands of businesses that are already operating in North Carolina and paying their taxes as law requires.
Well, practically speaking, as you're suggesting, or practically speaking, what it means is they have to foot the bill for the newcomers. All the current residents of North Carolina, the current employers of North Carolina basically end up footing the bill for all of these things.
Not exactly fair.
No, it's not fair. And the thing is, everyone wants growth, and that's what the politicians that are behind these things are pushing. They want something to say, look, we've helped bring growth about, because everybody understands that growth more than pays for itself. We know that growth is good. But the problem is with the incentives, especially when you juice them up the way that we've done in the transformative projects incentives, is that you're taking out all of the benefit and basically handing it over to the company so that the community doesn't shoulder the benefits as well as the cost. We get the cost, they get the benefits.
John, do we know anything about research into this area? Certainly there must be research that has gone to executives and said, hey, what are you looking for when you decide you're going to locate somewhere? Is incentives something that they are looking for now?
What research tends to find is that incentives are not the thing that these choices are made on. They don't swing on whether or not they're getting a certain level of incentives. If that were the case, Amazon would have gone to Fredericksburg, Maryland, just a little while ways away from where they ended up going, or they would have gone to New Jersey instead of New York City because it was just a few miles away. What's interesting is that in 2015, there was some research published that looked at people, corporate executives in North Carolina whose companies were getting incentives and some who, and others whose companies were not, asked them, gave them a list of 19 things that were important to the business community and said, which of these are the best? And incentives ranked very low, 15 and 16. Local and state incentives ranked 15th and 16th out of that list.
Out of 19.
Out of 19.
And 16.
So that basically
what was
they
on
said,
the top of the list?
Right. They said there's these 14 things we want to see more than incentives. And they were having an educated, skilled workforce, having low regulations. That was actually number two. Having low taxes and different kinds of taxes, having access to good transportation.
That's fascinating because in a lot of ways what you're describing and those things that made the top of the list are really reforms that we have seen here in North Carolina over the last half dozen years or so.
And that's what I think is crucial about that finding is that we've been doing the right thing and we've actually been seeing good results from it. Forbes just named us the number one state for business climate. So we're doing things the right way. We don't need to be chasing after these things just because other states are doing it.
And John, you've written that it is your concern, I think fear is probably too strong a word, but your concern that state and local policymakers will see this as a loss because they didn't offer enough of a package to Apple.
Yeah, that, I do worry about that because we did offer quite a bit. And so if they're to come away with this thinking, oh, gosh, we would have won it, but we just didn't offer enough when we were offering so much. And I think instead they should see it as ratification of what economists have said, which is basically, no, these things are made for business purposes. If they take the incentives, it's usually a cherry on top. It's usually not the thing that swings the whole decision.
In your writing about this, which, by the way, is available both at johnlock.org and at carolinajournal.com, you make an interesting distinction between economic growth and economic development. What's the difference between those two things? Because I know you're encouraging economic growth.
Right. Economic development policies are basically these kind of incentives policies where the government is taking a direct role in saying, we want to help these people over here. We want to target this particular industry. And everyone's attention is focused on that. And they say, oh, look, it's working. Economic growth policies are when the government steps back and says, we're going to keep taxes low. We're going to keep regulations low. We're going to get out of the way of entrepreneurs and risk takers and local mom and pops who are able to expand and say, we are going to make things better for them. And we can't chart all of it, but we can see it after the fact when North Carolina starts seeing great economic results, when we start getting nice mentions in publications like Forbes, when the Tax Foundation says we've got a model tax system. So that's what I'm looking at.
We've been talking with John Sanders. He is Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Free speech is one of the most important rights protected in the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights. But free speech faces attacks, and one source of those attacks comes from those who pursue so-called political correctness. Our next guest addressed this problem during a presentation for the John Locke Foundation and the Federalist Society, along with the National Review Institute. David French is a senior writer for National Review. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So free speech, we all know that free speech is important, but we really have been seeing this new line of attack on free speech recently, haven't we?
Yeah. You know, what we're dealing with now is less of a legal attack on free speech, although there are important free speech cases that the Supreme Court has decided. But the Supreme Court has been protecting free speech pretty consistently, with some exceptions, but pretty consistently for a while now, to the point where your freedom, you probably have greater freedom now from government interference with your free speech rights than virtually any time in American history. The problem that we have is cultural. Well, the problem we have are shame campaigns, other campaigns where people ironically use their free speech to try to silence free speech. In other words, you have a right to boycott, for example. So you try to boycott, economically ruin people you disagree with. You have a right to launch a shame campaign. So you launch a shame campaign with the design to silence someone. Or employers have the right to fire workers whose politics they don't like. So they use that right to cleanse their workforce of ideological disagreement. All of these things are a cultural effort where people, in a very short-sighted way, I believe, use certain free speech rights to silence, shame, terminate people who engage in dissenting speech. And it's creating a very, very toxic environment.
You mentioned that you think this is short-sighted. Why are these people being short-sighted?
Well, I mean, the reason why they're doing it is they're being empowered by hate and rage, which are contagious. Hate and rage are contagious. And one of the things that when you do not respect free speech rights, ultimately over time, what you begin to have is you begin to have a culture, including your own opponents, who do not respect free speech rights. And so what ends up happening is we are in a position where the only people who can be guaranteed to be able to speak freely are the people who are in a majority of any given institution. And it's a mistake that you think that you're always going to be in a majority in any given institution. Free speech rights exist not to protect the majority. Majority speech has the protection of popularity. Free speech rights exist to protect minority speech, to protect dissenting speech, including dissenting speech that we don't like. And so I think as a matter of principle, what's best for our society in general, we should protect the rights, free speech rights of people we disagree with. But it also happens to be in our long-term better interests as well, because you press out 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Do we know what the society is going to look like? Do we know if our point of view is going to be the one that's dominant? No, of course you don't. But if you protect a culture of free speech, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years from now, you'll know that you'll at least have the opportunity to share your views.
That is the voice of David French. He is senior writer for National Review. This is a different sort of challenge than the legal challenge
Yes.
involving free speech. How is this challenge different in the sense of the way you go about attacking it.
Yeah, you know, with the legal challenge to free speech, you file lawsuits to deal with that. And I have filed many, many lawsuits in my career defending the rights of people I agree with and the people I don't agree with. But defending the right of free speech, defending rights of religious liberty. And in a way, that's kind of straightforward. You know, you see government censorship, you move to stop government censorship, you collect attorney's fees, and then you go on. The cultural threat is much more insidious and much more difficult to combat. There are laws that can help. So, for example, laws that protect anonymity or donor privacy to prevent people who give money to causes, especially to controversial causes, to prevent them from suffering reprisals because of state-mandated disclosure. That's a legal protection when the culture of free speech starts to falter. And that's a very important legal protection. But you're not going to deal with the loss of the marketplace of ideas just through anonymous speech or just through donor privacy. It's a piece of it, but it's not the whole. So the whole is you have to make that cultural argument for free speech. You have to step up, make the argument, defend the right of free speech, defend the value of free speech. You just can't assume anymore that people will understand and respect free speech for what it is. You have to make the case for free speech as a value, even as you defend the right of free speech, even as you defend the ability of people to speak freely in private circumstance, in circumstances private and public.
You mentioned donor privacy, and I want to loop back to that because some people may hear this and say, wait a minute, isn't transparency important? That we want to know who is delivering these messages that we're hearing. It's important to know who's behind these things. Why is donor privacy such an important piece of protecting free speech?
Yeah, that's a great question because advocates for greater and greater and greater disclosure of the way in which people fund nonprofits and other entities that advance values and ideas that they agree with, they use that transparency word all the time. We want more transparency, we want more transparency. And it sounds great because who's against transparency? But the transparency obligation is for the government, not for the private citizen. So when we want transparency in a free society, transparency is a government obligation. Privacy is the individual's the privacy respects the individual liberty and protects the individual liberty. So it's literally we would like transparency for the government, privacy for the individual. The government doesn't like that. The government likes to flip that around and have privacy for the government. In other words, you know, opaque processes, opaque proceedings, where they want a high degree of public trust in the government and at the same time a low degree of governmental trust in the public. And so I think that's exactly the opposite of what a free people should seek.
If we had a reversal of the privacy that we now have, what would be some of the negative consequences we would see?
Well, you know, all the same consequences you see now in a world where, you know, a quarterback can win a Heisman Trophy and immediately have tweets dredged up from when he was 14 years old and used to humiliate him on the best day of his life. Or what we saw with Kevin Hart announced to be the host of the Oscars and many years old tweets are drug up and he's fired summarily or forced to step aside in less than 24 hours. And I mean, those are two examples from this week. I mean, you could just go on and on and on of examples of people who've lost their job, who've lost their public reputation, who've been humiliated and driven from public life because of, you know, people who use the search function on Twitter. You know, when you have a search function that could work much more globally on people's overall political activities, not just Twitter and Facebook, but the money that they give to the causes that they love, you're going to see – and you already have seen some people sort of hounded out of their jobs because of money that they've given. You would see that even more.
In the brief amount of time that we have left, do you have much confidence that we are going to see a sea change and have people more inclined to support free speech culturally than we have seen in recent years?
No. I think it's going to have to get worse before it gets better. You know, there's this concept, you know, you often hear in like addiction, drug addiction, that someone has to hit rock bottom. And I think in our rage addiction, we may have to hit a version of rock bottom, sort of a version of where we realize that the misery and the misery that we experience and the suppression of ideas that we experience is so extreme that people begin to rebel. Unfortunately, right now, I think the online censors are winning.
Well, on that cheery note,
yes,
we want to thank David French, senior writer for National Review, for joining us here at Carolina Journal Radio. Thanks.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The Trump administration finalized this summer a rule governing association health plans. These plans allow small businesses and the self-employed to band together based on their industry or their location. Grouped together, they can then purchase health insurance. The rule followed up an executive order designed to provide alternatives to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. During a recent speech on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, North Carolina Congresswoman Virginia Fox offered an update on association health plans.
Over a year and a half ago, we passed the Small Business Health Fairness Act. Small businesses were hit hard by flawed mandates, soaring costs, and limited choices under Obamacare. The Education Workforce Committee worked hard to produce the Small Business Health Fairness Act, which expanded health care options and lowered costs for working families by encouraging small businesses to come together through association health plans and negotiate for lower costs on behalf of their employees. In October of last year, President Trump issued an executive order that built on the solutions in that bill, directing the Department of Labor to remove barriers and make association health plans a viable option for businesses and their employees. Well, it's working. In my home state of North Carolina, individuals in the hospitality industry will soon have access to a new association health plan that provides affordable, comprehensive coverage. Nearly 500,000 workers in North Carolina alone will have options they didn't have before, thanks to association health plans. In Oklahoma, chambers of commerce at the state and local level are working with some of the smallest businesses around to form association health plans and allow these talented individuals to keep doing what they really want to do, innovating and creating jobs only they'll be able to create. Even farmers in Minnesota and Nebraska are finding ways to come together for better bargaining power that puts people and their health care choices first. Association health plans put people in charge. They empower small businesses to offer the same benefits that large companies can provide and allow employees to choose coverage options that work best for them. At the Education Workforce Committee, we've been proud to do our part to bring about this sustainable health care solution for millions of Americans. I welcome the news.
That's Representative Virginia Fox. She's a North Carolina Republican who has led the U.S. House's Committee on Education and the Workforce. She's touting the benefits of association health plans. Those plans are designed to help small businesses and the self-employed. They've been touted as one alternative to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. The federal government finalized rules for those plans back in the summer. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Millions of people know Brian Kilmeade as an anchor on the Fox News Television Morning program. But he's also an author, interested primarily in telling stories about important pieces of American history. A John Locke Foundation audience recently heard Brian Kilmeade discuss both aspects of his work during a public presentation in Raleigh. He started first with talking about Fox News.
This is just a remarkable opportunity. So when people say you work a lot, I say, can you keep a secret? I'm not working. Because I'd be the most annoying accountant, the most annoying gym coach, because I'd be talking about the news, and I'd be talking about Trump, and I'd be talking about Obama, and I'd be talking about the Mueller report, which, by the way, can you lengthen this whole study a little longer? I don't think it's long enough. So the other passion I have is for the country. And the one thing about Fox News, people say, oh, you're to the right, to your left, this guy's more moderate, this person's more conservative. All we are, we get up every day, the one consistency is, we know we live in the best country ever created, and by being born here or becoming here, we hit lotto. And I think I get a perspective on that because of the household I grew up in, because of the people around me, and because of instinct. If you just look at American history and you see how unlikely we were to be even created, let alone to survive, let alone survive, let alone thrive, let alone becoming the number one economic and military power in the world, you say to yourself, there's got to be somebody pulling the strings for this nation. We're not perfect. We make mistakes, but we admit them. We get better. We grow faster and harder. And people get upset from the outside, and they say, man, America's coming apart. Do you see the argument? You see the investigations? No. We have different points of view, but we're all pointing in the right direction. Make the country better. It just so happens that we have the best ideas how to make the country better, and other people that don't agree with us don't understand that yet.
Brian Kilmeade's most recent history book focuses on Andrew Jackson, specifically the North Carolinian's critical role in the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the War of 1812. Kilme reminded his audience that Jackson was once revered by the American public.
What has happened over the last few years? For the first time, from when the country was founded and when he died and when he was buried at the Hermitage, that includes prior to the Civil War, his grave was defiled. There's a group in New Orleans who live and breathe every day to find a way to take a statue down out of New Orleans. And they were trying to take him off the 20. Donald Trump kind of put a stop to that, or a pause. So that's what I think we're in danger of. And that's why I want to double down and talk about history with people that care, like you guys. Because for some reason, our history, which we know we're not perfect, but I think what's great about America is we're trying to be. And we go back in time and we don't say Jackson's perfect, Columbus is fantastic, General Washington had no weaknesses. We know they all had weaknesses. Who could ever justify slavery? It's unthinkable that the smartest men on the planet could somehow justify it, even though on some level I think they all knew it was wrong. I'll never justify that. But there's a lot of things we're doing now that generations in the future will laugh at and say, what were those people in 2018 thinking? I never thought history should be looked at like that. I think you should study it, not judge it. And that's my hope, that I'm going to introduce to you different stories along the way. I'm going to go out of my way to make sure they're accurate. I am not interested in writing for the Harvard professor. These professors write for themselves anyway, not to be read. I'm interested in the so-called average everyday American who is so very busy, will have to pick up and put down that book whenever they have a chance, whenever the kids aren't crying, or you're not running to a game where you have to go work overtime or go to an event. That's in my mind.
After his history lesson, Kilmeade offered some predictions for the new year.
I want them to get something done. I am so, I don't mind. But keep in mind, for those of you who are clapping and you're conservative, that might mean compromise. I want to debate who got the better deal rather than debate who benefited politically from the lack of a deal. I am so sick of it. Well, the Republicans got to pay the price of the deal at the ballot. Well, Democrats are going to be responsible for the shutdown. Well, Republicans are going to be, if they don't build a wall, it's going to get the electorate motivated to go vote. I am so done with that argument. I think you also have to be ready not to get everything you want. I'm okay with not getting everything I want because the way our system was set up, we're not supposed to. What happens is, if you make your ideas better and you communicate them better, what happens is, at the ballot box, you'll end up with over 60 senators and the majority in the House. And then guess what? You'll get everything you want. And virtually everything you want, but there's always a moderate and a Susan Collins and a Joe Manchin on the other side. They'll say, yeah, it's going to be a problem. But that's just the way we're set up.
So what are Brian Kilmeade's political predictions for the coming year?
I predict, number one, this Mueller thing's got to wrap up, I think, before the new Congress takes over. I predict that Democrats will overstep in their investigations. And they don't understand. There's a part of Donald Trump who actually wants to fight every day. To a part, it's like Mike Tyson when he was 19, you know? So there's a part of him, where, like you and I would be so stressed by this, we'd have to say to ourselves, why do I need it? There's a part of him who wants that edge. I don't know if you heard, but he's on Twitter now. And I think he hit 12 tweets before I walked up here today. So that's what I predict. And I just hope that something's going to surprise us. I just hope it doesn't come from ISIS, who is starting to rumble that they're trying to do something in New York City. We can never take our eye off the ball there. And I love the fact that we reassert ourselves in Iraq. That government now wants us there. They no longer take us for granted. I think Iran has overplayed their hand big time. And I see things getting marginally better. The one good thing is I think Israel is no longer isolated like it was. There's a lot of Middle East nations that are working with Israel in a way many people didn't think possible. So I think that's heartening. I also take heart in this. I don't like when you put down a president, whether it's Obama, Clinton, Bush, or Trump, you put down us. And what the French have done with this Macron in his tight suits and his older wife, kind of just smugly putting up with Trump and tolerating Trump, I think, on how to play Trump. Well, congratulations. You and your 26% approval rating have upped the taxes so high in your country, who only wants to work 3.5 days a week, that there's wild protests in the street. You have relinquished, backed off, because green energy is great when you can fly like a private jet like Bernie Sanders or Al Gore and show up at a green rally. But when the average person who's barely making ends meet finds out that gas is over $7 a liter or a gallon, whatever measurement they're using, and it affects their life, They're going to go on the internet, they're going to rally, and they're going to send a message. Congratulations, you put down Trump, he's got 46% approval rating. You got 22, and when the riots happened, you went on vacation this weekend. So, and there's a reason why this Brazilian leader just won. There's a reason why Australia just rotated through. There's a reason why Merkel's on her farewell tour, and Theresa May has never had looked more comfortable dancing than she has recently in presenting Brexit. All their ideas, from their lofty ideas, and those professional politicians are falling on their face. So before you're critical of Trump and say he's naive and doesn't understand the position, what are you doing?
That's Brian Kilmeade, morning co-anchor on Fox News and author of several American history books, including his most recent book on Andrew Jackson and the War of 1812. Kilmeade delivered these remarks to a crowd of more than 300 people in Raleigh, put together by the John Locke Foundation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It is unconstitutional. That is the ruling from a federal judge in Texas about the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. U.S. District Court Judge Reed O'Connor ruled on the case filed by 20 Republican attorneys general. So why did the judge rule this way? And is North Carolina impacted? And what does this all mean for the future of the delivery of health care and health insurance? Jordan Roberts is healthcare analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He's been taking a look at the ruling, and he joins us now. Jordan, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So tell us first about the ruling. On what basis is Obamacare unconstitutional?
So this ruling is all about the individual mandate. That was the part of Obamacare that basically forced people to acquire insurance or pay some sort of tax or penalty if they didn't comply with that. So during 2017, the Republicans in Congress passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And in that bill, they zeroed out the penalty for the individual mandate. And if you remember back to the original Supreme Court case that upheld the Affordable Care Act, Justice Roberts' opinion said that that individual mandate penalty was a tax, and so that fell under Congress's full authority to tax and levy taxes and raise revenue. So now that the individual penalty is zeroed out, this is a non-revenue-raising illegal coercion by the unconstitutional coercion by the federal government.
We have often heard some of the critics of the Affordable Care Act refer to it as a house of cards and that it will implode on itself.
Right.
Is that what we're seeing here?
Basically, so the Obama administration argued that there's three main parts of the Affordable Care Act that really get to the core of what it's trying to do. The individual mandate that require people to have health insurance, and then you have these other two parts, what are called community rating and guaranteed issue provisions, and that helps prohibits insurers from denying and or offering different coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. So without the individual mandate, which could not be severed from these other two parts, the whole law falls down when one of them is unconstitutional.
So it's either all three of the provisions working together, or if one falls away, then none of this works.
That's right. And that's what Justice Reed O'Connor said, that because this is now a unconstitutional tax or unconstitutional provision in the Affordable Care Act, then the whole law must fall down.
Jordan, does this apply to North Carolina?
In a way. So here's where we are right now. We have a district or a federal court judge that gave us this ruling, but he didn't really give any action, and we're waiting for that action now. So you have possibility in the states that they could codify some of the parts of the Affordable Care Act, make it law in their states. You have Congress that could potentially codify some of these parts of the law and send it to the president's desk saying that these are going to be laws through and through, no matter what the court decision. So we're really in a limbo stage right now. There's a lot of different action that can happen, and we're really waiting on the appeals process by other Democrat attorneys general or other further ruling from the Texas judge.
What does this mean for people who currently buy their health insurance through the Affordable Care Act?
So that's another thing. We're kind of in a limbo there because starting January 1, 2019, when there's no revenue-raising tax on the individual mandate, different levels of government could just choose not to enforce the law. State governments could choose not to enforce the law. Different federal agencies could choose not to enforce the law. So that's really where we're at right now. There's just so much uncertainty, and we're in limbo because of how the judge ruled on this case.
So many moving parts here.
That's right.
In terms of public policy questions and decisions that need to be made, also in terms of legal questions, potential appeals, and other people saying, hey, how can I make this apply to my state, or make sure that my state is shielded from this type of ruling. So we know there's a lot of unanswered questions, but Jordan, we've been talking about this darn thing for years now, right? Since I believe it was 2010 when the Affordable Care Act first came to be. You, as a healthcare policy analyst, look at all sorts of different options, and you've written something interesting in your commentary about this ruling. As we move forward, you have challenged people, and in fact, urged people to not look at this discussion of how we deliver care and how we provide insurance as either doing something with Obamacare, maybe nibbling around the edges of that, or going to this new proposal we hear from many on the left about Medicare for all.
Right. So that's always just baffled me in this debate that it seems like it's a binary discussion that's presented to us. We can either choose to operate with this flawed Obamacare law, or we have to move to something that delegates more power centrally in the federal government. And, you know, I think the biggest thing to remember here is that this is a perfect example of when you centralize all this decision-making power in one point, the federal government, court cases, different congresses, and all these things can affect such a big part of the American economy. And so I think this shows that, you know, there are other alternatives, and that involves pushing these decisions back to the state governments and letting the states determine what's best for their health insurance markets instead of a one-size-fits-all DC approach to healthcare.
Well, if we don't do a one-size-fits-all DC approach, then we want to try to put something together here in North Carolina that gives people more choices and more options. So how do we go about that?
Absolutely. So in an ideal, perfect world, we would have full control of the health insurance markets through the state. And the state could, you know, remove some of the regulations that prevent competition between insurers, and so we could have a true competitive market where consumers are purchasing insurance from insurers, the insurance that they want, and there's no regulations, there's no excessive taxes. It's just a open market where the state regulators are in charge and allow a lot of free-moving competition.
What you're describing really, to me, sounds like just common sense, that let people choose what it is that works for them at whatever point they are in their life. And for some people, that may be full, complete coverage where they're willing to pay a premium in order to have a very low deductible and have everything under the sun covered. Other people may say, look, I just only want insurance for, you know, something catastrophic happens to me, particularly millennials, younger people taking a look and saying, maybe I don't need to go this very traditional route.
Absolutely. And I think that just speaks to the argument that we need more choices in healthcare. People need to have different options rather than just either getting their insurance through their work or through the Obamacare insurance places. So I believe that this is a step in the right direction, that we need to remove this one-size-fits-all DC healthcare framework and really give the states options to give their consumers in their state the products that they want and they need, and let the market drive innovation and drive the correct coverage that patients need.
I know that one of the issues that you've been looking at the state level that would indeed allow more access and lower costs and work with innovations has to do with something called certificate of need, mm-hmm. a state law that essentially puts all sorts of rules and depresses competition. Why is that so important to you to help people understand what that does to the marketplace?
Well, certificate of need is just it works in direct contradiction with a free market and innovation. It does not allow the market to determine the participants, and it doesn't allow consumers to buy products based off of their needs. And so freeing healthcare facilities from these certificate of needs that require a state permission slip to build new healthcare facilities, that just frees up the market to respond to consumer demand, which is what we really lack in the healthcare sector today.
It's just one of the many issues that Jordan Roberts is analyzing and writing about. You can read all of his work at johnlock.org, and particularly his analysis of this new ruling out of the Texas court about Obamacare being unconstitutional. You can find it again at johnlock.org and at the Locker Room blog. Jordan Roberts, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.